Nous prions que le Saint-Esprit vous plaît, Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta, Shamini Tanamini. Namaste Saraswati Devi, Gauravani Pacharane, Nibhasesha Sanyavadi, Pashkati Desutane. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Nyupataya evate nayayorantam anantatataya. Svamapiyarantarandalichaya nanu suvanaha. Kaivarajam sivanti vayasasayat shuttayas. Vaihi phalanti antanrasanena bhavannidana. I'm going to. I'm going to move on to the translation as we've read this verse a few times, and then we'll move on to the purport, and Krishna willing, we shall conclude this verse today, which is the final prayer offered by the personified Vedas to Lord Vishnu, to Lord Narayan. So this final prayer sums up the essence or the purport of the other prayers. Please listen carefully, and then we shall repeat. Because you are unlimited.
Because.
No. Please listen carefully, and then we shall repeat. Because you are unlimited, neither the lords of heaven nor even you yourself can ever reach the end of your glories. The countless universes, each enveloped in its shell, are compelled by the wheel of time to wander within you like particles of dust blowing about in the sky. The Shrutis, following their method of eliminating everything separate from the Supreme, become successful by revealing you as their final conclusion. Please repeat. Because you are unlimited,
neither the lords of heaven,
nor even you yourself, can ever reach the end of your glories. The countless universes, each enveloped in its shell, are compelled by the wheel of time to wander within you like particles of dust blowing about in the sky. The Shrutis, following their method of eliminating everything separate from the Supreme, become successful by revealing you as their final conclusion. Now, without looking. Does anyone remember anything from the verse? And then we shall ask about from the purport that we read yesterday. From the verse that we just heard. What do you remember? Raise your hand though. Yes.
Even the Lord can't speak all his glories.
Yes. Even the Lord, or even you yourself, can ever reach the end of your glory. Speaking, knowing. This is incredible. It is more than incredible. It is inconceivable. He, by definition, is inconceivable. To understand the way his mind works, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is beyond our comprehension. We cannot understand it. He is inconceivable. How he can not understand his own glories, and how he can have the potent universes, which are themselves unlimitedly complicated, and there are unlimited of these potent universes, each with their shells, and they're wandering, being blown around with him by the force of time, which is another of his energies. One energy is interplaying with another energy, and those countless universes, which from our perception are so vast, but they're floating around in him, being blown by time, and they appear as insignificant as dust, particles of dust being blown around by the wind. Excuse me? The wheel is spinning and they are blown around. Just like the fan spins, the wheel of the fan spins and blows the air around. And here we are, and sometimes, you know, pardon the expression, but arrogance, we, first of all, we say, I'll believe that a God exists if I can see him. Arrogance, yes. Just imagine if we wanted to go, we demand and pound on the door of the Prime Minister or some extremely important person in this insignificant planet, insignificant country, in an insignificant planet, in an insignificant universe, compared to a particle of dust. And we demand, we in our arrogance and our inconsequentialness, demand, I want to see the Prime Minister, and I bang on the door. Now what happens to such arrogant fellows? Or what? Yeah, what happens? Huh? They come with a big net. Because such people who have such arrogance must be considered crazy. Don't you understand who you are in relationship to this person, and who are you to demand? Who are you to make demands? What is your qualification? Do you have any true business worthy of him, or do you have a relationship with him? And examine both of these. If you have some business worthy of this Prime Minister, then you will be let in because you have an appointment, and then you will discuss things with this person on the level, and only on the level, of the specific business that you have with him. But if you have a loving relationship with him, if you have an intimate, loving relationship with him, actually speaking, you can walk in any time, and you can discuss anything. the demigods and other very powerful persons, they have business relationship with him. And that limits their access and also the range of topics that he will discuss with them. But his dear most intimate relatives, most intimate because of the love, they'll never betray his trust. And therefore they can go in at any time. And they can discuss anything. Those are the resonance of Vrindavan. But where are we? We never have our... We don't really have any business on his level, nor do we have an intimate relationship, and yet we demand. And that is arrogance, that is foolishness, and really it is madness. But it is better to come to his door. There is a facility to come to his door. He comes in the form of Sri Vigraha Atramurti and allows us to come at any time when the doors are open, when he's not taking rest, to come at any time and make our usual petty, small appeals. Just like I once knew one devotee who he used to drive. You have to go now? Okay. What were you doing in school today? Will you remember Krishna? Will you try very hard to remember Krishna in school? In your heart, you can be thinking, oh, Krishna, you are so wonderful. How I'd like to play with you. You're my best friend. Because you even come with me to school, and no one likes to go to school. But you like to go to school. That's okay. You? Okay. You're very sure about that point, I noticed. Okay. Hare Krishna. Have a good day at school. So, I once knew one... you're going to school also? Okay. Have a good day at school. And take Krishna with you as your best friend. Hare Krishna. Everyone who has to go to school now, they can go. But everyone should take Krishna with them. So I knew one person who used to drive a car for the temple. And he said to me, do you know Ambarish Prabhu, Alfred Ford? Could you ask him if he would give me a car? Now this person is a very, very good devotee, and of course, and how many people are asking him for cars and this and that and this and that? But it's a petty, somewhat self-centered. But Krishna is so kind that he opens the doors of his temple. And the mood when we go to the temple, Krishna's temple, is like approaching the king. So what happens if you have audience with the king and your mobile phone goes off? Not very good. And then you ask him for something. He's saying, this person doesn't know where he is. What happens if you start talking to your friends and everything like that and having distracting... Or you're in the king's chambers and you're so fortunate to have an audience with the king and then you just turn your back on him. What would that mean if you're turning your back on the king? What does it mean in relationship to your mentality?
Carelessness.
Not carelessness, but yes, it could be careless.
It's rebellious.
Rude, disrespectful. disrespectful. So if we want to understand the rules and regulations for being in a temple, we think of it in those terms. Very, very simple. And that is the meaning of aparad, offense. Very, very simple, actually. It's disrespect, and when we disrespect someone, they become offended. Quite simple, in a sense, to understand. And we have that common sense, or we should have that common sense. But the more intimate they can come in, of course, they can come in and they walk in the behind, and they're very, very careful, and they have to make sure they're in the right mood before they do their puja. They have to remember they may be playing with someone outside, but then when they walk in, they have to make sure they're very, very clean, and that their internal purpose is harmonious in alignment with what their activity is. That's called Buddha Shuddhi. Aligning your consciousness with your activity. Very important. And very often, when we approach Krishna, we forget that one step. Even when we chant Krishna's holy names, we forget to align our consciousness with what we're actually doing. Or when we're even sweeping the floor of the temple room, or distributing books, or cooking prasadam, or cooking something for his pleasure, for their pleasure. We forget to align our consciousness with what we're doing. And the results we wonder why we don't get the results that we so strongly desire. It's because we forget this one point. It's a matter of aligning our consciousness. So whatever service we do, we should not do it as work, because work, karma, there is a result for that we have to get because we're just working. But if we do it as seva or service, it's completely different. Completely different, and the result will be completely different. So that brings to another interesting question. Well, what happens if Aditya or someone has to go to school, or someone has to go to the office? Is it possible to do that aligned with service, a serving mood? It is possible, but we really must do that. Not because we can't bluff, be doing it for me. We can't be doing it for me and have that mood of a service mood. The two are incompatible. Selfishness and service are incompatible. So we can be a little bit unselfish and have a little bit of a service mood, which is better, much better, far better than not at all being aligned properly with Krishna. And that's really, really the essence of Krishna consciousness. The essence of Abhideya Tattva, Srila Jiva Goswami describes, is performing this one activity. The one activity being aligning ourselves properly with Krishna according to who we actually are. And who are we? We start with the most common point is that we are all servants of Krishna, and the problem is that we have our back to Krishna. So Srila Jiva Goswami uses this term even. He uses Bahyamukh or Vimukh. Our face, our mukh, is turned opposing Krishna. And the process of Krishna consciousness is simply the process of turning towards Him. But that takes not only a physical movement, it takes a movement of consciousness. That's what it really takes. And therefore, Prabhupada, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, for evoking that internal change, that internal movement from having our back turned toward Krishna, towards facing him. And facing him means more than just the physical facing of him too. It means of facing him in devotion, in love, in prema. Prema, pumarto mahan. This is the great gain, and this is the great gain of Krishna consciousness. And then, based on our prema, our being aligned properly with Krishna, and that is the alignment. The alignment is one of consciousness. It's alignment of love for Krishna. Then we can become intimate because of the trustworthiness that comes committedly with love. Then we are allowed to understand, naturally allowed to understand Krishna in his most private and intimate dealings, because we are completely trustworthy. Instead of banging on the door, I want to know you, Krishna, you prove to me that you exist. You prove to me that you're really the Supreme Lord. Well, you prove that you're worthy to know that. That's my part. And Krishna will do his part, for sure, but we have to mostly worry about what our own part in the whole thing is. So he is unlimited. We should contemplate what unlimited means, that he has unlimited qualities to an unlimited, each one of them to an unlimited degree. This is who we're dealing with. How wonderful it is that he comes in the form of his holy name that gives us access in a simple way. How wonderful it is. A simple, easy to access way. We can just chant Krishna's names. We can just come before the deity. Sri Mutaya Shraddhanaya. That we should approach the deity. There's no exactly word in English for Radha-Vallabha, what they are. We say the deities. What deity just means the god. That's what they are. They're the gods. Or they're the supremes, if we're thinking about it. In some of the devotees, they joke, because the supremes, they're a musical group, or they were anyway. Well, they're the supremes. And they made himself so easily approachable. And then Mahaprabhu, teaching us how to approach him, says, but so they're so easily approachable, but unfortunate as I am, even though they are there for me, doors are open, I'm so unfortunate that I have no attraction. And what is it? And this is the question, or this is a question we should ask ourselves. What is it that makes me so unfortunate that I don't have a deep attraction for my awakening, my loving relationship with Krishna? But yet it's not, I don't have deep attractions for things. I have unlimited deep attractions for things, but not this. And then, you know, we can examine those attractions with our intelligence based on shastra. Will they give me what I want? Do those who have those things that I so I cherish in the core of my heart, do the people who have those things? Do I want the result that they have attained by having these things? Do I want to die a billionaire? Do billionaires die happily, smiling? Or are they in the greatest torture because they've spent their whole life developing attachment to the power that all that money gives, and that's what it really is. It's power. You have the power. If you have $65 billion, you have the power to... of course, you don't have the power to walk down the street, because, but you have the power. When everyone sees you, they smile. Is that true? What do you think? If you see someone walking down, you go, when you see them and they look at you, and you just smile, hoping they'll throw you something, a crumb or two. just a $1 million, that would be enough. And after all, that's not even the interest on the interest of your interest. They walk and everyone smiles. And that's one of the ironies of life, is that when someone has so much money, wherever they go, everyone pays for them, whatever they do. Figure that out. But do such powerful people, they tend to get so attached to the wealth, to the fame, to that someone's strength, to one's knowledge, attached, and then when it's time to leave this world, when the soul is departing the body, due to the attachment, there is such suffering because you tried to hold on tightly and you can't, and you have your unfinished plans and you tried to hold on tightly and you want to do this and you want to do that, and the forces of nature that pull you from your body are unlimitedly more powerful than your desire to hold on. Such pain, forced, and then you're accountable for every toe that you stepped on your way to get that, every lie, every cheating, every power play, every this and every that. And then you have to pay for that. Your karma comes because you've done it just for you, and there is no... Yeah. So, is it that a person who has the things that I cherish, are they happy? We have to ask this. And then if we conclude that they are not, what is it that can make a person, a soul, truly happy? And when we ask that question, who am I? Why am I suffering? Kayami, why do the miseries of life attack me, although I don't desire them? Why is it that when I get my desire fulfilled, it still doesn't bring me the happiness that I long for, that I hoped it would bring me? When we ask those questions sincerely, then human life begins. Let me finish this purport, actually. We read two-thirds of it already. Now here's the last third. There are many statements of Shruti that carry on the work of the Antanirasanam, the process of distinguishing the Supreme from everything inferior. So that's the process of the ascending. Nati nati vyatirek process. It's not this, it's not this. It's of a different quality. This unlimited Supreme Lord is of a different quality. So here, because things are proved by Shastra, so here the Shastra is quoted. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishads, because especially this is the Shruti, or the Upanishadic prayers, for example, states, and there's a Sanskrit verse that I won't even attempt, right here. It is neither big nor small, short nor long, hot nor cool, in shadow nor in darkness. So this is, it is not this, it is not this, it is not this, it is not that. Nor is it the wind or the ether. It is not this, it is not that. It is not in contact with anything, and it has no taste, smell, eyes, ears, motion, potency, life, air, pleasure, measurement, inside or outside. So when one looks at this neti neti process, if one perfects it, one will understand what the Lord is not. And one will, and one can do that actually by the power of one's own intelligence. So it's very appealing. And one will undoubtedly come to an impersonal conclusion as to the, not quite identity, but as to the substance of the ultimate reality. One will come to an impersonal conclusion because it's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. And then when one strips away all the material qualities that we conceive of, that we can possibly conceive of within our own consciousness, we're left with no material substance. And therefore we can say that the absolute truth has nothing that I can, is nothing that I can conceive of, basically. And therefore, due to, again, perhaps a tinge of arrogance, we leave out that last part. The absolute truth ultimately is nothing that I conceive of, because my conceptions are limited to matter. We leave out the what I can conceive of and boldly assume that this is the nature of the absolute truth, that it is nothing, rather than understanding that my conceptual ability is quite limited. And it cannot penetrate into the spiritual realm. It cannot penetrate into the realm of Goloka Vrindavan by my conceptual ability based on my finite intelligence, any more than when I look at the atta flour, the wheat flour, when I'm rolling a chapati, and I try to speculate about the identity of the farmer who grew the wheat and what his children are like. There's no way, by examining the wheat flour, I can understand the very nature of the intimate identity and nature and his likes and dislikes of the farmer. We cannot penetrate into Goloka Vrindavan, the spiritual world, by our ascending inferential abilities. Ascending meaning rather building upon what we see to understand the ultimate. So therefore, but yet you can understand something about the ultimate, but you can only understand what it is not, basically, and have a very, very broad understanding of what it is. It possesses, the ultimate possesses nothing that is tinged by matter. So more of this definition by negation, as was discussed, that's mentioned in the Kena Upanishad. It declares, this one I'll try in the Sanskrit because it's simpler. Anyade vitad viditad dato viditad adi. Brahman is distinct from what is known and also from what is yet to be known. So very, very contradictory type of qualities are described, and very, very mystical, esoteric qualities are described when describing in this way. From the Katha Upanishad, it says, Anyatradamad, Anyatrasmad, Kritat. Brahman means the greatest, is outside the scope of religion and irreligion, pious and impious actions. According to the rules of linguistics and logic, a negation cannot be unbounded. There must be some positive counterpart of which it is the negation of. In other words, if we say that this is not a horse, we can say this. Yes? Yes? Do we have an agreement? Yes. It's hard to get everyone to agree about anything, but we just did it. This is not a horse. I'll drink to that. But therefore, if the negation of something exists, is true, therefore the object that it is negating has existence. That's the point, the puzzle. So a horse does exist. And therefore we can understand this is not a horse. So that's the simple point here. A negation cannot be unbounded. There must be some positive counterpart of which it is the negation. In the case of the Vedas, exhaustive antanirasanam, their denial that anything material is absolutely real, the counterpart is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By saying that there is nothing that is real, that means the concept of real does exist, that there is some reality. And it's so the positive that the negation is speaking about is ultimately Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God, which is the point of this verse, where it says, these Shrutis who speak in the negative, not this, not this, not this, their true success is they reveal you, O Lord, O Supreme Lord, and your existence. You, person, supreme, unlimited person. And then finally, there is a prayer. It concludes this by a prayer, a very wonderful prayer by Srila Sridhar Swami. Dupatayo vidarantam anantate natcha bhavan nagira shruti molaya twai falanti yato nama ityato jaya jayati bhaje tavatat padam. The gods of heaven, this is his almost paraphrasing in Sanskrit the prayer and the conclusion of this final verse of the Shrutis. The gods of heaven do not know your limit, O endless Lord, and even you do not know it. Because the transcendental words of the topmost Shrutis become fruitful by revealing you, I offer you my obeisances. Thus, I worship you as the absolute truth, saying, all glories to you. All glories to you. The very reversal, this devotional mood is the inverse of materialistic consciousness, because in materialistic consciousness we wish to say, either subtly or grossly, we wish to say, all glories to me, all glories to me. All glories to me. And that's the turning to that we have to do, is understand, first of all, that I'm insignificant. In 100 years from now, 200 years from now, will anyone who exists even know that I ever existed? And I'm trying to say, all glories to me, all glories to me. Quite unlikely that all glories will come to me. And quite inappropriate for me to try. But when we turn to Krishna and understand the very nature of the absolute truth of the Supreme Lord, and give, try to glorify him because he is truly glorious, then that turning to him places us in reality as opposed to illusion. And reality is much better to deal with than illusion. Because illusion, before our eyes, even if we're very expert at maintaining an illusion, in time it will turn into smoke. No substance, because it's illusion. And reality, on the other hand, even if we are expert at denying it, we can make an experiment after, we can try to deny this wall is here, and then we could run into it. We really get really firmly convinced, and then boom, and see what. No, actually, I'm not recommending that, actually, because you all know what's going to happen if we try that one. So illusion has its way of revealing its true nature in time, and reality similarly does as well. Both the nature of illusion and reality are both unavoidable. So we should turn to Krishna. We should chant Krishna's names. We should face him properly. We should not turn our back to Krishna. And we should act in such a way that Krishna will be pleased. And then if we do that, then also we will be pleased. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yes.
In the verse and also in the quotation from Sri Ramaswamy, it mentions that Krishna's glories are so unlimited that even he doesn't know the limit of his glories.
Yes.
That would seem to indicate that he's limited.
Yes. But since this is the third day we're speaking about this verse, and since we spoke about that yesterday, and since it's in the purport also, that point is addressed, I'll just read it. It's part of a comment by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. If you yourself cannot find your own limit, if that's the case, it's in the form of a dialogue. You yourself cannot find your own limit. And then Lord Vishnu says, if that's the case, what do you mean when you call me omniscient and omnipotent, which is your question? We conclude, and here's the reply, we conclude that you possess these features of omniscience and omnipotence from the very fact that you are limitless. Certainly, if one is ignorant of something that does not even exist, like a rabbit's horn, that does not detract from his omniscience. And if one fails to find such a non-entity, that doesn't limit his omnipotence. So the point being that if one cannot find something that doesn't exist, so, and the example given here is a rabbit's horn, if you cannot bring the horn of a rabbit in front of me, one could say, well, then you're not omnipotent. And because you can't find that rabbit, you don't know everything. But that's saying that's not very logical. Something that doesn't exist does not have to be known for someone to know everything, and something that does not exist does not have to be brought into the presence of someone for him to prove his potency, his all potency. So the parallel here is that the Lord's glories simply do, the end of them, the limit of them, do not exist. He's unlimitedly glorious, unlimitedly potent, unlimitedly beautiful, unlimitedly knowledge, filled with unlimited knowledge. So therefore, the fact that he doesn't know his limits, because his limits don't exist, and he can't display his limit, doesn't detract either from his omniscience or his omnipotency. That's how Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur answers that point. And in fact, that there is always an eternal, forever, limitless competition between the Lord and his potencies, because his potencies are always expanding because he's unlimited. And then his knowledge potency, by which he knows himself, so his potency expands. And as it's expanding, say if it goes from here to here, for example, and his knowledge potency only up to that point knew up to here. And therefore there's something that his knowledge potency doesn't know, but then it knows it, so his knowledge potency has expanded too. And then he's expanded. So it's unlimitedly expanding. Krishna's knowledge, his potency, is everything. So this is inconceivable. And then you throw into this equation that he's a person and he has an unlimited form that's, by definition, a form has boundaries. He has an unlimited form. Then we're really beyond the capacity of our finite, tiny intelligence to understand. But that shouldn't surprise us that we can't understand the unlimited Supreme Lord, because we're tiny and insignificant. And if we could fit him, God, the Supreme Unlimited, the Absolute Truth within our tiny, and we did understand him fully, then he obviously wouldn't be greater than we are. And what would be the use of worshipping him if he was as great as I am? But anyway, that's the simple understanding that's given. Any other questions or comments? So that's one point, that you can use it in service later. So if you keep that in the forefront of your mind, that the purpose that I'm going is to serve Krishna, if that actually burns within you, actually, not in a superficial way, but if that's actually burning within you, and then, so what you're doing, you want to do it in such a way that will allow you to offer properly to Krishna, offer yourself, or become qualified to serve Krishna. And then, also then, but then you're there also. Now what do you do while you're there? And that's a wonderful meditation. And that's something that should be, if one is pure, that will be in the mind. How can I do this? It's a meditation, it's a thought, it's an openness to the possibility of Krishna using you in his service in this particular situation. Keeping oneself open and keeping one's desires open to being instrumental to Krishna. And being instrumental to Krishna is what gives pleasure to the soul. You could say the theory. Now what can you actually do when you're in the university while you're actually there going about your day? What can you do? So the first thing, the theoretical is, on one level, is you desire to serve. And if the desire isn't there, then regardless of the opportunities being there, you won't take them, because it's like no matter how much food is there, if you're not hungry, if you've just eaten a big feast, it doesn't make a difference what possibilities are there. So the primal thing, the foundational thing, is to have the consciousness, the heart, in a devotional spirit, and then let the opportunities present themselves by Krishna's grace. So that, you know, the simple obvious things is we can distribute prasadam, you know, there's so many things you can actually do depending upon who you are, what your nature is, you know, and the circumstance too. Because one time when I was in Hong Kong, I was studying Chinese, Cantonese, and in an establishment, and I was shy to go in devotional clothes, and so that helped in one sense, because then I could just merge in with everyone else, but then everyone started speaking to me about the things that people speak to each other about, and it was just such garbage going in my ear continuously, you know, it's what people talk about when they think you're just the same as them is just, you know, anyway, I don't need to give any parallels here, but examples, but it's so then I finally I decided I'd just go in a dhoti, in a kurta, and then everyone really did leave me alone after that. Funny about that. Tilak and the whole thing. But so according to the circumstances, that you may be able to do that or you may not be able to do that, and who you are and what the circumstances are. And I know that you can actually pray to Krishna. pray to Gaurna Thai, pray to Srila Prabhupada, pray to Radha Balava, pray to Jagannath Balava, that they send you someone to talk to about him. And that's that type of prayer, let me serve you somehow now, is keeping the when the consciousness is willing, if it's receptive, then it's there's like a channel for Krishna's mercy. And Krishna's mercy is always there, it's shining like the sun. But it's not like the Melbourne sun, which gets covered by clouds all the time, or some of the time. But it's always there, and our point should be to keep ourselves open to it, our consciousness open, and that's basically through desiring. Hare Krishna. Okay, any other questions or comments? And that's the hard part, too. Proper desire. I sort of made it sound easy, but because here we are in a very materialistic, material world, which is built, it's engineered, it's designed to corrupt our spiritual desires, to place so many trinkets and what's the word I'm looking for? Sparkly, so many enticing things before us so that we desire to, we try to enjoy them, place ourselves in the center as if everything in existence is meant for my pleasure. That's what the material world is meant to do. It places, entices us, things before our eyes, before our nose, that awaken in us, or, you know, desire to exploit. Exploit is a good word because it's such an unpopular thing. We don't like to be, no one likes to be called an exploiter. Or thief, that's actually what it is, too. It's thievery. Placing ourselves in the center. And what happens is we desire to, we're enticed to enjoy, we make attempt to enjoy, and then we actually just get frustrated because we don't have the capacity to be the enjoyer, because that's Krishna's position. But so the material world, or we could say Maya, is looking, or is always testing. We say, oh, I want to serve you, Krishna, I want to desire you. And Maya says, oh really? Let's see. And then Maya does something, just finds that little weak point right between the ribs or something, and just pushes that button, and then we see, oh, I still have a long way to go. And then what we have to do is just fix our intention again and try again. And get up and try again. It's humiliating. But that's good, because by humiliation we learn to be humble and dependent. Any other questions? We have another few minutes. Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Sri Sri Gaurna Thai Radha Balava, Jagannath Balaji Subhadra Bhaktivinoda ki jai.